Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Descanso, 89.1 FM, the network for social justice. Today, my very special guest is Georgette Gomez. She's the California Democratic Party's endorsed candidate running in a field of 13 in the 53rd Congressional District seat being vacated by Congresswoman Susan Davis due to term limits. Georgette was the first LGBTQ Latina elected as San Diego City Council president, and if she wins this race, she'll be the first LGBTQ Latina in Congress. As City Council president, she has worked to expand affordable housing, strengthen protection for low-income renters, and took a leading role in implementing the city's climate action plan. She holds a degree in environmental and nature resource geography from San Diego State. As former associate director of the Environmental Health Coalition, she led the Toxic Free Neighborhoods campaign to protect children from dangerous chemicals. The daughter of immigrant parents, she grew up in Logan Heights and now lives in City Heights with her partner. She says she wants to focus on the needs of working families and communities, and she's running ads promising to take on the Trump administration's policies, too. Georgette, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. Can you start by telling listeners who may not be that familiar with the district which communities are in the 53rd district?
Yes, most definitely. Happy to do so. So the District 53rd is what I keep referring to people. It's the heart of San Diego. So it covers Mission Hills, Old Town, North Park, Hillcrest, South Park, University City. It goes into some of City Heights, Kensington, Talmadge, going all the way east to El Cajon City. So it also covers the city of La Mesa, the city of Lemon Grove. Mm-hmm. And then it goes further south to National City and also the city of Chula Vista.
So does it take in Spring Valley, Jamul?
It incorporates Spring Valley as well. And I believe Jamul.
Yeah, very good.
Yes.
There's a good chunk of East County in there as well.
Most definitely. So it's really, I mean, it's a very exciting, very dynamic district.
Yes. A lot of different needs. So tell us why you decided to run for Congress.
Yes. So right now, I'm the council president of the city of San Diego. And I have learned very quickly that in order for us to really achieve and address the issues that people are living with, such as better education, infrastructure that our communities are desperately in need of, the housing crisis, our climate crisis, and I know the cities are doing everything that we can as cities to really advance solutions, but we need the federal government to really also invest in our communities to really advance real solutions. So for me, it really is about that. It's about really being committed, but also going to DC to bring more resources to advance better education, our infrastructure, create better jobs so people can actually live in our region and afford it. And more importantly, our climate crisis is an issue that we're facing nationwide, and we really need to prioritize it. And that's why I'm running.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good. Well, I was going to ask your top priorities, and you've kind of listed a lot of them. So we'll drill down and we'll go into a little more detail on some of those. Mm-hmm. But first, I know a lot of people are also concerned about health care, mm-hmm. maybe not an issue for the state council so much, but at the national level, that's one of the top things everybody's saying they're concerned about in the polls. I myself had my health insurance premium this year go up to $1,000 a month. Jeez. With two of us, it's $2,000 a month. It's more than a mortgage.
Right.
So you've said you support Medicare for all, mm-hmm. to assure access to affordable health care. Can you clarify, would your version eliminate private insurance, or would you give people an option? And also, how would you address prescription drug costs?
Yeah, so definitely Medicare for all, I think, is the ultimate solution that we really need to work towards. And it's something that I'm very supportive of, and that I will be very active in making sure that it becomes a reality. Now, I'm very also much mindful that it's going to take time. We need to really figure out, okay, what is the path? So once I get to Congress, I'll get to work on it very quickly, mm-hmm. And build support for it. In the midst of doing that and getting there, we need to ensure that currently, right now, there are people that are impacted, regardless of what type of healthcare we have or not. We still have residents that are underinsured. They do not have the luxury of having healthcare. It's not accessible.
Yeah.
It's very costly. And even for those that have it, it's a huge hit financially. So right now under Trump, and we're not talking about it enough, under Trump, he's attacking what we currently have. He's actually questioning and diluting what Obama created. So it is very important that we protect what we have while we start building the perfect solution that will hopefully make it more accessible to all residents.
Very true that President Trump has rolled back a lot of the protections under Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And now in his new budget, there are attacks on Medicare and cuts also in Social Security. Mm-hmm. If you're elected, will you pledge to preserve, protect Social Security as well as Medicare?
100%. I think that's an issue that it should be. I've said it during the campaign trail. Healthcare, Medicare, even ensuring that our senior citizens have a security when they retire, all of that is under attack under current administration. And it's something that instead of attacking it, we should be making it even stronger, but instead we're going backwards. So it's definitely something that I'm going to be fighting against, making sure that we're protecting it and expanding what should be a basic right.
Okay, thank you for that. What would you support at the federal level to expand affordable housing and accessible housing for everyone, and also to reduce homelessness and resolve or address the homelessness crisis in our region?
Yeah, no, this is definitely an issue that I've been engaged significantly at the city council level, and it's going to be something that is going to be one of my priorities as well when I get to D.C. Right now, the Department of our Housing, HUD, what we make reference to as HUD, the Department of Housing, is under attack once again. In his current budget that he has proposed, HUD is being cut. What does that mean? That means that the programs that they manage, which is our Section 8 vouchers, are not getting enough money. So what does that mean at the local level? I'll give you a perfect example. The city of San Diego, we have a waiting period of vouchers to get a rental assistance for over 10 years. That means people that are needing the assistance now, right now, have to wait 10 years.
Yeah, one of my photographers is in that bind. He was telling me, Miriam, I might have to move out of state. He's an elderly gentleman on disability and, you know,
right.
His landlord's jacking up the rent and he has no place to go.
Exactly. So one of the things that I really want to do is really fight to make sure that our housing department is getting the resources that it needs to really assist the very bottom. That's going to be a very critical issue for me. I want to also make sure that we also give assistance to provide support for the development of more affordable housing. That's something that is critical and has been being cut back under Trump's administration. So I'm going to be a strong champion in making sure that we're fully funding the department. But more importantly, once it gets funded, another piece that we need to correct is California's populations has grown.
Yes.
The way the distribution that the Department of Housing distributes its resources, it hasn't been updated, and that's based on the formula per population. So we need to correct that. We need to update that to ensure that California's is getting its fair share.
Okay, great. Under the Trump administration, a lot of people may not realize yet, listeners, that just in the last month, the president has announced huge rollbacks in clean air and clean water protection, some of these dating back 50 years through both Republican and Democratic presidencies and Congresses. He has also, of course, as we know, withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accord, wants to open up offshore in California to oil drilling, fracking, and most recently, opening our national parks and national forests to things like oil drilling and big energy projects. A lot of people in East County are very concerned about Cleveland National Forest and what could happen to that. It's one of our real treasures. We have Bureau of Land Management land out here as well. So, Georgette, can you tell me what you would do to first, of course, address climate change, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, as well as improving protections for clean air and water and some of those other things?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues that we're facing as a society, but climate is above the most important issue that we're facing nationwide. the climate crisis. And it's really unfortunate that Trump is, instead of elevating the importance of it and investing and trying to figure out in ways that we can start transitioning to really protect and dilute our impacts to the environment from air, water, we're going backwards. California has been the leader in terms of the state, has been the leader in setting high standards to force cities to reduce their greenhouse gases. That really has, because California is forcing cities, now the cities are having to create climate action plans. And basically that is the roadmap in which each city is going to reduce its impacts to the climate. That's something that we should take as a model nationwide.
Now, Obama had set goals that were similar to California's.
So that was eliminated under Trump. Mm-hmm. So we need to bring that back because that really sets the blueprint enforcing cities, enforcing states to really start getting their act together, to really build a real plan in which we're going to start eliminating our greenhouse gases. And that is in various different ways by starting to invest in renewable energy. Now, the city of San Diego has partnered with Chula Vista, La Mesa, and I believe Encinitas, and we're creating a path to actually achieve 100% renewable energy. That's something that it's got to be expanded further. Yeah. And that's a perfect model that we can take throughout the nation. And then we also need to start investing in our infrastructure mm-hmm. and how we move around. Transit is a perfect example, but also East County, I know that we don't have the population to invest on transit, but we can create our roads that are more efficient to get people circulating faster. Yeah. They're not idling.
Carpooling.
So there's other ways in which we can start moving people in a more efficient, more environmentally friendly way.
Even better bus service. I hear a lot from people
most
in rural
definitely.
Areas that if they need to go to the doctor, there's a bus maybe once a week. Well,
right.
How does that work if you can't get into your doctor the day you need to? There's a lot of talk about the Green New Deal, and of course the idea of reducing greenhouse gases is critical. I think most of us agree on that. There have, however, been some negative impacts in East County from some of the big wind turbine projects that have gone in very close to houses and in wildlife-sensitive areas. You may not be that familiar with it, but these things are 500 mm-hmm. feet
oh,
tall.
Yes.
Yeah, bigger than the biggest.
They're big.
Yeah, huge. Bigger than a skyscraper. And they're putting them close to homes. Mm-hmm. And some people are having health issues, sleep disruption. The infrasound is an issue. The noise, it can be like being next to a jet engine sometimes when the wind's really blowing. Mm-hmm. Flashing red lights in people's windows, blade flicker. And of course, there can be bird kills and things. Mm-hmm. We've also had huge property value drops. Some people can't, and these are poor communities, by the way, mm-hmm. living many of them below the poverty line, and now they can't sell their homes. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there needs to be a little bit more care taken in the siting specifically of wind projects and maybe giving communities a little choice, saying we need the energy, but would you rather have solar? Would you rather have wind? Are there some other things that we can do? And if a project is found to be for the greater good and necessary, as with a freeway, should it be treated in the same manner where we compensate people for the loss of property value or give them the option to be bought out?
Yeah, no, that definitely is a very, very important question to ask, just because as we start creating plans to start transitioning from fuel to renewable energy, and renewable energy could be solar, could be wind, could be utilizing water, right? And so there's various different, even waste.
Yeah.
So there's a huge array of renewable energy. And really, I mean, what you described should be in the center of how we start developing renewable energy portfolio, just because it's going to impact us. Even if we were to build a solar farm in the East County, right? That's mm-hmm. going to impact land. So is that the best way to utilize that land? Or
right,
should we?
Agricultural land, maybe.
Right, exactly. So I think this conversation of how we develop the renewable energy portfolio in terms of who's going to get impacted, or even the siting of it, is mm-hmm. really critical.
Yeah.
And this should be the center of the conversation as we're moving forward, because it can lead to negative impacts, people's quality of life overall, as you described it. So I'm a huge proponent in making sure that we're siting it the right way, that we're utilizing current infrastructure. I mean, we have a lot of buildings. We have a lot of homes.
Yeah.
We have a lot of infrastructure that we can put, even parking lots.
Solar,
right?
Solar covers on the parking lots.
Exactly.
Of say, shopping malls out
yeah.
here or universities would generate a whole lot of power, and there wouldn't be as many negatives.
Right. And then there's new technology that, I mean, the renewable energy technology has evolved as well. Mm-hmm. So we just need to be very mindful as we're moving forward on where we're siting, who's getting impacted. And I am a firm believer that we need to start utilizing this renewable energy options and siting them where people are at, because that's less, also less infrastructure of travel. Which is also a lesser of an impact.
And you don't need all the power lines everywhere. Correct. Power lines to nowhere. You know.
So there's technology that we have relatively available. We just need to make sure that it's part of the conversation as moving forward.
As the daughter of immigrants, Georgette, how concerned are you about Trump administration policies toward immigrants and refugees, including family separations and the Dreamers, the young people who came here as children, mm-hmm. brought here by their parents? And also, as part of that, can you also address your views on border security? That is an issue for some of the folks, you know, that live near the border and are impacted.
Yeah, no, I mean, as a first-generation Mexican-American and daughter of immigrant parents, just to share a little bit about my story, my parents' story, I mean, when they came here undocumented, but they came here because they were impacted economically where they're from, Nayarit, Mexico. They come from agriculture, and the agriculture was wiped out because of the way the industries overtook the smaller and farmers.
Yeah.
So they fled because they wanted to provide a better opportunity for their children.
Sure. And some of that was NAFTA.
Correct.
Which flooded Mexico with cheap corn and other products from the United States, yeah. and it took away the farms and the mm-hmm. farm worker jobs down there.
Right. So for me, immigration really is a little bit of a connectivity to the trade discussions, because some of the trade discussions have led to people having to immigrate over here.
Very true.
So for me, I've never seen the connectivity of expansion of trade to immigration, and we really need to do that. So that's something that I really want to add to the conversation of the whole immigration conversation and even trade. So definitely I'm interested in engaging more on that when I get to DC. I do believe that we owe it to, if we're going to start expanding trade, we owe it to the people that we're impacting at the other end of the stick, which is the countries that we're getting into agreement for trade to open up the market, because it's going to impact our economy there. Because
yes.
unfortunately, the outcome of the trades is cheaper labor. People are getting, they're basically are being forced out of their countries or out of their, because they're not getting paid enough.
Yeah.
So that's why they're fleeing. Or there's, you know, there's other reasons as well, right? There's safety aspects to immigration
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, drug cartels, the violence in Central America in particular.
Right. So we really just need to acknowledge that and really create real infrastructure and really talk about immigration from that lens. I think it's been talked about from a lens of hate, of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the reason that I really want to, this is one of the reasons why I'm very excited about being open to my ability to engage in other conversations outside of the conversations that I get to participate at the local level. Immigration is one of those that will allow me to expand my influence as an elected. I really want to bring a different perspective to the conversation, which is a little bit more humane and really tying it to some of the decisions that we are trying to expand our economic opportunity here in the States. It's also impacting migration from other countries.
Right.
So for me is just really trying to bring that connectivity. And I do know that my parents, like I said, my parents immigrated because there was a economic impact. So mm-hmm. they came here. They worked a lot.
So you think there should be a legal path to citizenship?
Definitely.
And what about the family separations? Would you call for a stop to that?
Oh, most definitely. I think that's inhumane to really think about it from, you know, taking away my politics and everything that I believe, to separate families, to separate children from their parents. It's
yeah.
just something that we shouldn't be seeing. That's not an American value. And we really need to stop that.
Yeah.
We need to provide infrastructure and support when people are being held for vetting, which right now the way that our infrastructure is, because Trump is not providing enough resources, we are putting people behind jail. We are putting children behind jail. That's just something that we shouldn't be standing.
Months and months or having a leave in Mexico policy where they're in danger. They're out there in the freezing cold and
exactly.
the rain.
Exactly. That's
months.
Inhumane. Regardless of how we feel, it's inhumane and we don't treat people like that.
Another candidate in another office has talked about adding more immigration judges just so we can process them faster, and whether they're granted asylum or not, the process would be faster and families could stay together for that short period.
Most definitely. We need to put more resources. We need to restructure the system. Policies need to be updated as well, because it takes a while because of the antiquated policies that we currently have. Mm-hmm. And also, more importantly, what we've been seeing now, we have policies that don't allow our officers to provide health care during the period of flu, which we're in it. People have died. And they're not allowed to provide health care.
They were turning away, the Trump administration was turning away doctors who had come to the immigration facility right here in San Diego.
They were wanting
folks.
To provide the service for free.
Free vaccinations.
They were being turned away. Yeah. And people were dying. Children were dying.
Dying of flu, children.
Correct. So that's antiquated policies that need to get updated as well.
Now, that said, obviously there is some legitimate security concern, because it isn't just people crossing the border anymore because they want jobs. They have occasionally found, you know, terrorists or gang members or cartel people, drug smugglers.
Yeah.
How would you address the security part of making sure that we know who is coming into the country?
Right. Of course. I mean, having a safe border, I mean, it's something that we need, and we need to make sure that it's done from that lens. And nobody, I don't think, at least for me, I can only speak for myself, I'm not arguing that we need to tear down our entire borders and just create a free flow. But what I am arguing is that we really need to have better checks and balances. Even currently, Border Patrol has been given even more leeway to do what they choose to do, and there's very little accountability.
Right.
So that's not checks and balances whatsoever. So we definitely, from a security perspective, of course, we want our country to be safe, nothing against that. But even over the years, we've seen that the people that are crossing aren't the criminals, aren't the people that are wanting to come here.
Right, most
to
the vast
do
majority
fear.
Are
They're not the terrorists. Yes, for the most part. Mm-hmm. So the emphasis of that's why we need to militarize our borders even more, build even bigger walls, it isn't about that anymore. So I think we need to backtrack the conversation and really look at it from a humanity aspect of, and being good neighbors as well.
Okay. You have criticized the Trump economy as working for billionaires and millionaires while working families are struggling to make ends meet. The economy isn't working for everybody. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that a bit and tell us what measures you would support in Congress to help workers and their families? And also, do you have ideas for bringing more good-paying jobs to our region?
Most definitely. I mean, as we talked a little bit about trade has really led to a lot of our manufacturing industries have left outside of the states, right? We need to bring that back. We don't have the middle-income jobs that we used to have to the level that we used to have them. So we need to be more creative as we're engaging in the Green New Deal and really transitioning and protecting our environment. We have an opportunity to create those that industry here in the U.S., and we should be very much making sure that happens, and it's not going to be going away to Latin America or China or somewhere else, just because we have that ability, and that's going to get people to work and creating the new technology that we need, desperately need, to make sure that we're protecting our environment. So that's an opportunity that we can have to grow more. Our infrastructure throughout the states needs a lot of upgrades. All right, that's going to require a lot of money.
Crumbling roads and bridges.
Our water pipes, our gas pipes, our bridges, our roads.
Our dams. We have dams here in East County that are very dangerous.
Correct.
That are in danger of possibly collapsing if there were an earthquake.
So we need to prioritize our infrastructure, and it is time that we actually move forward with the transportation bill that has not been updated or adopted. It's just been expanded. It's time that we adopt a new transportation bill, that it's more money getting U.S. Residents to work in this in the infrastructure upgrades that we desperately need. And that really is creating middle income jobs that will hopefully pay better and will allow people to have a little bit of more money to really have an ability to survive. Right now, the industries that are growing are the low-paying industries. We need to think about it differently.
Yeah. You've talked about the importance of supporting labor and unions that helped build the American middle class. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the 50s when we had a lot of good-paying union jobs,
yes.
We didn't have the high homelessness and poverty rates that we're seeing now. I do have a question, though. There is a bill in Congress called the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize. It actually just passed the House. It'll probably come back, you know, at some point for amendments or whatever again. My question for you, though, is that there was language in that bill that also targeted independent contractors as patterned after AB 5 in California. And AB 5 has actually harmed, you know, thousands of people who are artists, musicians, journalists. It's affected our industry, nonprofits and small businesses that hire these people by making it. Basically, it's going after the gig economy, you know, the Ubers and Lyfts.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people are losing like their entire livelihoods now because of the bill. My question is, do you think that it needs to be a little bit more nuanced with some protections in there for a lot of these independent contractors? A lot of them are older workers or disabled people of color, women who want to work for themselves. They, like me, you know, I've got a parent with dementia and, you know, need to be able to set their own schedules and choose when to work and not to work and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. And I think, making reference to AB 5, Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez, I think the intention of that bill is the right intention. And then she has said it. I mean, I know that she's starting to reintroduce new language to amend the bill. I don't know what the new approach is.
So maybe she paused the federal level or that clause taken out of it until we see how it works out in California.
Most definitely. Well, we need to have a conversation. Just because we are seeing a big boom in the alternative way of doing business, right? There's good about that, but then there's also the mega industries that are taking advantage of it,
right?
Such as the Uber, such as the Lyfts.
So maybe some limits on the size of the
companies
it would apply to, or something.
There needs to be a better conversation of what really are we trying to do, and how do you craft it in a way that it's not impacting the mom and pop. I agree with that.
Yeah.
But that's a really critical conversation that I'm glad that she took on. It wasn't easy, but we're learning from that. And I think she has said it. And I think there's definitely something important to say about making sure that individuals are not being taken advantage by an entity.
We shouldn't have Uber drivers making less than minimum wage.
Exactly.
So I agree with that. You have called fixing our criminal justice system a human rights issue as well. Can you explain, and what would you do to make the system more equitable for everybody?
Yes. Historically, we have an industry that has targeted brown and black communities, and it's based on antiquated policies. It is time that we revisit those policies, that we're updating them, that we're investing more in our communities. I mean, we talk about safety. What does that mean? That means better infrastructure in our communities, better investment in programs, school programs, education, and making sure that families are not just parents, that are not just busy working and they're absent from their children's lives. So there's a lot of that I really would want us to revisit in terms of how we are approaching safety. It's not just about investing more in public safety. It's not just about building more jails. There's a criticism in the brown and black communities that that brown and black children are, and there's plenty of data that backs it up, that they're landing in jail versus getting their degrees in education.
Yeah, and
that's
more
reality.
More apt to be convicted for
exactly
the same crime that a white person would be maybe given parole
because they have better, they can hire a lawyer.
Or in prison.
Right? So there's these inequities that are a reality. So we definitely need to invest more on brown and black communities, first of all, to start creating a better path, better bridges, so the community members have access to education, have access to better jobs. and they can live.
Yeah, break that pipeline to prison.
Exactly. So that really is what I want to do and really start reshifting our priorities as a nation.
Yeah. You have called for more protections against gun violence in the wake of all these terrible mass shootings that we're seeing in schools and just about everywhere else these days. You've also talked about gun control to save lives. Can you tell us what you think the most important steps are to take? And do you support the Second Amendment right to bear arms within a framework of also having reasonable protections against these mass shootings?
Oh, most definitely. I think, the Second Amendment doesn't call for just a free-for-all, right?
Taking everybody's guns away.
But. Correct. No, there's got to be, I'm a firm believer that if you're going to be owning something that can lead to somebody dying, which is a gun, right? That's people's choices. There needs to be checks and balances. I'm a firm believer that there should be a license attached to a gun. There should be background checks, universal background checks. And there are certain guns that shouldn't be allowed to be owned.
You know, the Supreme Court has held that you can have some limits. Right now you can't go out and buy a shoulder-fired rocket launcher or a tank.
We shouldn't.
you can't even buy a true assault weapon,
right.
But you can buy a semi-automatic, weapon that can be adapted to be like one. So it really isn't a question of whether guns can be regulated in some fashion or certain weapons found to be things that only the military should have, perhaps, or people with a particular special need. It's just a question of where you draw that line.
Right. And that's a conversation that we really need to have, that it's been delayed for far too long. And we are seeing the fact that we're not having the conversation, we're seeing the outcome of it, right? Where there's been mass shootings, where it has led to children dying. That is not an America that I want to be a part of. So I definitely want to help out in advancing those conversations to really lead to real solutions that, no, it's not going to take people's guns away.
Yeah.
The city of San Diego adopted a safety for people that are going to own guns. They need to keep them under lock. That's something that should be a mandate as well. I don't think that's infringing in the Second Amendment whatsoever. It's just, if you want to keep it, if you want a gun, it should be under lock when it's not being used. That's just, it's a common sense solution.
Thank you. How would you reduce the high cost of college and college debt for students?
Well, I know that there are proposals to have a debt-free college, which I'm a huge supporter of. There's a few things that I believe that should be a right, which is healthcare, education, and I think that really leads to a better quality of life overall for people. I know some community colleges have started doing a free 2-year college. That's something that we have a model that we should be expanding upon. But education should be accessible to people. I'm a graduate of San Diego State, and I was able to get my degree because I was getting Pell Grants.
Yeah.
And that's a system that is also has not been invested in. It's less available to people.
Right. And yet the cost of college is just skyrocketing.
And the cost of colleges are just continuing to increase, and students are leaving colleges with a huge debt. And that's impacting their quality of life. And then when they leave, there are no jobs.
Yeah.
So we need to change that. And I think colleges definitely need to invest in colleges. We need to make it cost efficient and if not free. That's something that I'm a firm believer on.
Okay. What do you view as the most important foreign policy areas to be addressed? And how would your policies differ from that of the current administration?
Well, foreign policy is definitely an area that, for me, it's a new area. Obviously, I've been spending a lot on the local issues, on just overall environmental issues, housing here, just in terms of binational. I've been very involved going to Mexico and building relationships with the new government entity to just really strengthen the relationship. In terms of foreign policy, we definitely, from my perspective, it shouldn't be about imposing in countries to say this is the way you should be running your country. It should be really just being a supportive entity, a supportive arm to lead to democracy in other countries.
Where do you stand on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, or have you formed an opinion on that one?
No, I have. I have formed an opinion on the Middle East. Basically, I believe in a two-state solution. I strongly believe that both entities need to come to the table to really figure out how to draw the lines. And I think the U.S. has a responsibility in fostering that discussion, but we shouldn't be imposing it as well.
How about the Iraq, Syria, Iran situation? To what degree do you agree or disagree with the policies that have been in place there, I guess both under Obama and Trump?
Well, I think Obama did a little bit better than what Trump has done in terms of advancements.
Yeah, these are areas where we've had troops for years and years and years now, and yet there is still the threat of ISIS. So it's a very complex situation.
So, I mean, it's definitely a complex discussion that I'm not going to claim that I know what the right approaches are. And I know that, I mean, we're previewed to what we're hearing in the news. I am very much mindful that when you're part of the discussion of what to do as a decision maker, it's not a black and white. Like, walking away from the Iran deal was not a smart solution for us. We have seen how it's played out. I would say that we should try to foster a new conversation to try to create a new deal. I don't think just by saying we should bring it back, I think the conversations have shifted, but it definitely is something that we need to figure out in a way that we can go back to addressing, to bringing back that conversation and trying to figure out what that deal should look like.
Susan Davis served on the Armed Services, still does, serves on the Armed Services mm-hmm. Committee. She's been a big advocate of taking care of military families and veterans, and especially women veterans as yeah. well. I would like to know what your priorities would be when it comes to the defense budget, including both defense spending, but also the spending on, you know, defense of America and our military, but also the military families and veterans.
Yeah, I'm going to start by talking about the families. And I do think that we need to invest more on supporting families. We need to make sure that we're building housing for our military families. We don't have enough housing. And then also making sure that we're investing on transition. When people are leaving the military, what is that transition plan? And really have a real plan to start making sure that there's support, there's jobs available, and the spouse as well. We need a better support system, intentional support system. When children are having to move around, that's an impact to their health, their well-being. So there should be a program in the support system as well. I see that our veterans that are living in the streets, it is really inhumane that we're asking serve, and then when they come back, we don't have a proper infrastructure. So now they're living on the street.
Yeah,
that's shameful.
Sad.
We need to do better. And I know that we can do better. We're a very wealthy nation. So it's just about priorities. It's not just about thank you for your job. Thank you for your service. Now, good luck.
Yeah.
And best of luck, which is kind of the structure that we have. And then we also are asking, actually, going back to immigration, we are asking people that are undocumented to enlist with the promise that they're going to get documentation afterwards. That has not delivered. We need to make sure that we are actually holding ourselves accountable to the promises that we're asking people to do. We need to make sure that we're investing in people and our families that are being asked to serve. And we're not doing that. In terms of the budget for military, it's important, especially San Diego is the number one economy is our military. So definitely need to continue. But we also need to reassess how much and what is it that we're allocating the money for. I think there's potential to restructure and really start creating different priorities as well.
We do have a national deficit that under Trump is actually the all-time high. What steps do you propose, if any, for reducing that deficit? Are there areas where you could see cuts in the budget? And how would you propose to find the funding to pay for programs such as universal health care and some mm-hmm. of the other things that you've talked about that a lot of people would like to see?
Yeah, so definitely areas to cut. I would start with our military spending. I think that definitely is an area that we can reassess and really figure it out. Another way in which we can really create more money is I'm a huge proponent of cutting, closing the loopholes for corporations, which there's a lot of loopholes where they're not being taxed. Big size corporations get taxed less than smaller ones.
Yeah, when large corporations are paying zero.
Zero. That's an area that we should really discuss and tax it. And I know that that's not been something that has been very popular in D.C., but I'm definitely a supporter of that.
Yeah, can you tell us who the major funders are, or funding sources for your campaign? I know money's been an issue in this race.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we are running a strong grassroots campaign, have raised a little bit, close to 700. Thousand. I'm looking at my colleague here. Mm-hmm. And most of it is coming from all sorts of people, individual people, unemployed people that believe in what I stand for, which is the working class.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers, unions are supporting me. We have some congressional members are also supporting me that have supported me by giving money as well. But most of it is grassroots. Most of it is me doing calls, asking people. I have Justice Dems have endorsed me, and they have sent out an email list, and some people have been donating. So we have a huge array of supporters, from teachers, bus drivers, people that are working in the grocery store.
Just ordinary people, not big PACs for corporations.
No, I actually took a no PAC, no corporate PAC money pledge. So I'm getting zero money from that. I'm a firm believer that if we really are going to create a government that is accountable to the people and not corporations, I gotta walk the talk.
Okay. If you're elected, what committees do you hope to serve on?
Oh, wow. Definitely my number one is the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. I think there's a lot of work to be done to really improve our nation, and that's a really key conversation that I really want to be a part of.
Who are your major endorsements that you're most proud of, and where can people get more information about you and your candidacy?
Yeah, so I'm going to start by the local endorser. So I have Assemblymember Shirley Weber that has endorsed me,
mm-hmm.
The mayor of La Mesa,
Dr. Apostathos.
Yes, Dr. A
yes.
has endorsed me, as well as Councilmember Akilah Weber.
Mm-hmm. So there's some bipartisan endorsements there. That's great.
Yes, I have the mayor of Chula Vista, Mary Salas, as well. So I have a lot of local endorsements. Our state senator, Tony Atkins. I have over 16 congressional members that have endorsed me, starting with our Congressman Juan Vargas. Senator Bernie Sanders has endorsed me.
Presidential candidate.
I have the California Democratic Party. I have the teachers union, the nurses union, the trades as well. So I have a huge coalition from workers to electeds, local electeds that really care about the district itself, 53rd district.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really proud of that. And then we have a lot of people on the ground, regular residents in the office every single day.
Very good. Where can people find more information on your candidacy?
Yes, our website is georgettegomez.org, and I would be happy to talk to anybody.
We have been speaking with Georgette Gomez. She is the president of the San Diego City Council. She is running for Congress, as you've heard, in the 53rd Congressional District, and if elected, she would be the first LGBTQ Latina elected to Congress. Georgette, I'm going to let you have the final word today. What else would you like our listeners to know about your candidacy for Congress?
Yes. Well, once again, thank you so much for inviting me. I would be very proud to earn the support of the 53rd Congressional District residents. I'm a first-generation San Diegan, born and raised in San Diego. I've been working my entire life in improving the quality of life for all residents, but more importantly for our underserved residents. And the reason being is that that's the community that I come from. And I'm a firm believer that government, no matter which government, local, state, or the federal government, government has the responsibility to invest in people, to invest in their environment, to invest in creating better, stronger bridges that are leading to a stronger and a more prosperous life for all residents. And that's why I'm running, to make sure that we're investing in people, that we're protecting our environment. And I really want to welcome everybody to participate in this very critical decision. And I would be very honored to earn the support of the residents of the 53rd.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.